Bulgaria was deathly quiet while they had sex, which had creeped him out a little. She didn't even breathe differently while he pounded into her, reaching his critical point when he was going to explode and put his snow on her belly. Doc is thinking about that now, as his roommate shifts in his bunk below. He's not thinking about why she was quiet. That does not concern him in the slightest. He's recalling what it felt like to pound into her. It's very sad how normal it becomes to masturbate in broad daylight with your cellmate right there in the bunk underneath you. Doc almost does not need to tell you. Sometimes, in the middle of the night, Doc thinks he can hear the entire cell block whacking off, a low chorus of wet rhythms. Gross, you are probably thinking. Doc would like to remind you these are human beings. Blood rushes into their penises whether or not they are incarcerated, and when a human penis is engorged and there's no imminent possibility of sex, the male human will instinctively wrap his fist around his engorged member and pull on it in an up-and-down motion. Which makes him think of that joke. It's the only joke he can ever completely remember. All the jokes that come and go, horse walks into a bar, how many cholos does it take to what? He can't even remember the opening. In all his years, only one joke ever lodged reliably in his mind. Guy and his wife are having marital problems. They don't screw is the problem. So they go to a what-do-you-call-it, a sex therapist. The therapist says it sounds like they aren't good at communicating their needs. The man and his wife agree that it's embarrassing to talk about sex. The therapist suggests they build a language of physical cues, a way to let the other person know when they're in the mood. The wife says, "Okay, honey, how about this? If you're feeling frisky, pat me on the stomach twice. And if you're not in the mood," she tells him, "pat me on the stomach once." The husband says, "That sounds good, dear. One pat, I'm saying not tonight. Two pats, let's get this party started. And here's the code for you. If you feel like fucking, rub my dick one time. If you're not in the mood, rub it 100 times." The guys at Rampart referred to the Bulgarian girl as Doc's mail-order bride, but no one from the outside ever understands about two people and why they get together. He was 23 years old, a rookie just out of the police academy. She asked him for directions on the street. He liked her dimples and how she could barely speak English. He gave her a ride where she was going and got her phone number. She was like an orphan in a huge unknown country. Doc adopted her, for a while, and she was good at cooking and cleaning. But she sulked a lot, and he realized quiet people can control you just as effectively as loud ones. They do it differently is all. He got tired of the sulking and crying and ended it. He was divorced at age 27 and planned never to marry again. He enjoyed women and had quite a few. Didn't love any of them. Had not loved the mail-order bride. 10 years after his divorce, he met Betty LaFrance and fell for her. Fell hard, for this woman who neither cooked nor cleaned and made a great deal of noise when he fucked her. Although it might have been theater, and what was the difference? In what way would such a difference matter? The point was to get off. In a twisted way, he misses Betty, even if he would love to have her murdered. He's tried, but it seems impossible. She's on death row, and there is no way to get at her because women are too stupid to commit inspired acts of prison violence. In a men's joint, you can put a hit on anybody. People will do it for cup of noodle. They'll kill for payment in bars of Irish fucking spring. Smells good, makes a good jerk lather. But the only women who can get to Betty are the other sad psychos on death row, who probably lie around whining and crying, while the men exhibit resourceful qualities like filing a locker hinge to a chest-immolating point or embedding a razor in a toothbrush handle so they can tomahawk someone's face off. Betty, though, was a can-do broad, unlike most broads. In a way, it was why he'd liked her. If he needed to put out a hit, Betty would be the one female who might be capable of such a thing, but since she was the target, it wasn't an option. Betty used to nag him that his women issues were a mother issue. But what did Betty know about Doc's mother? Doc himself knew little, since he'd only lived with his mother until age 5. He remembered asking her what she did for her job because she was always bringing him to strange men's homes and leaving him to sit on a couch by himself for what felt like small eternities. Favors, she'd told him. I do favors. Betty had said she wanted his baby, but it turned out her uterus was broken. Or maybe his cock was broken. He means it worked fine for fucking, but she didn't get pregnant even though he aimed his scrizzle inside her plenty of times for the sake of a possible Doc Jr. Normally, Doc would prefer to ejaculate on a body, or ideally, a face. Horace walks into a bar. And the bartender says, "Why the long face?" Rub it 100 times. The hilarity of that joke never dimmed for Doc, even though sometimes you wanted to do the rubbing all on your lonesome. In prison, there's little choice in whose hand be on your own, unless you want another man grabbing your cock. He once gave a handjob in here, and if you're a not-gay man and you've never done it, whoa, are you in for a surprise. Another man's erect cock to a straight guy feels like a root vegetable. Women are used to it, and every guy knows the feel of his own hard cock, but with your own, you don't feel it, you make it feel. When Doc touched someone else's member, somewhat like his own, but not his own, it sent him into biofeedback brain scramble. He pulled his hand away and did not go through with the act. It was one of those Powderpuff softball trannies. She was a pretty Latin honey, and he wanted her to beg and whimper and throw her head back like an actual lady might. It would be something different in a place where there is almost no variation from day to day. But then the chick had a huge erection in her pants, and he doesn't like to think about it. But sometimes he lets himself think about it to remember not to do it again. The only penis he touches is his own. He is touching it now. Most men whack off most days. Then you wipe away the tears, the evidence, and everyone knows and no one knows. And the truth is, you actually cannot hear that kind of activity on a collective or choral scale in Doc's unit. The stroking and jerking are just something Doc assumes, which is how many kinds of knowledge function. You don't wait for the empirical evidence. In this case, you don't want it either. You know. You just know. Betty had this way of challenging him to be a son of a bitch. She liked low-down, dirty people and had a special thing for cops. She and Doc drank a lot, did a lot of cocaine. Betty liked to eat hers. He'd never met anyone else who did that, ate cocaine. He himself preferred the efficiency of injecting it. Coked up and in love, he had stupidly assured her he was the dirtiest of cops. It was how they related. It was pillow talk. Stupid words people say to each other in a sack, about various abuses of their power, shit they got away with, people they'd killed. Betty, facing the death penalty, dredged forth everything Doc had ever told her. He was convicted for the killing of Betty's original contract killer, and for another contract killing he'd been involved in years earlier, of the manager of a gentleman's club. But there were two more people whom he'd wasted, although they had no proof on those, could not convict. One was a guy no one misses. The scumbag had just raped his own 5-year-old son. A neighbor, fed up with the abuse, had called 911. Doc was the first officer to arrive on the scene. Guy wasn't even done zipping up his pants. Kid crying, bleeding from his anus. Doc told the suspect to relax, and as soon as he put his hands down, Doc started firing. The joke about Linda and Richard was actually Doc's own, his story. But when he told it, people always thought he was kidding. He was in high school when that happened. It was a single experience, but his whole adolescence, the life of Richard Lynn Richards, a.k.a. Doc, could be summarized in that moment of humiliation by a girl named Linda at the soda fountain on Magnolia Street in Burbank. You could fit his life story on the head of a pin. I'm not Linda. Floyd and Lloyd were real people, brothers who were married to Doc's two great aunts. One of Doc's few recollections of those unfriendly old women and their brother husbands was a joke he sometimes tried to tell. Floyd had a peach and took a bite. He turned to Lloyd and said, "This peach tastes like pussy. It's incredible." The juice rolled down Floyd's chin. He handed the peach to Lloyd, who took a bite himself, but spit it in the grass. "Tastes like shit," Lloyd said. Floyd told Lloyd he had to turn the peach around, that he'd bit the wrong side. Doc gets confused. The joke has to be told like a scene, but it's not a real scene that he witnessed as a boy. Floyd and Lloyd, his uncles by marriage, never spoke to each other. They were men of zero words to anyone, ever. They were men who lay watching TV, making women and children feel skittish and in trouble for existing. Plus, another thing, and everyone knows this, it is not about Doc's tragic family, it is universal. Peaches are delicious, truly delicious, and they do not, he repeats, do not taste like shit. Chapter 13. My cellie Romy got transferred, but I didn't know where. Big Daddy refused to tell me.
"Mind your own business, Fernandez," he kept saying.
I was alone now. Another lady on ADSEG claimed they'd moved Romy to suicide watch. I didn't believe her. ADSEG is a big rumor mill of people locked away and shouting through their door. Big Daddy would not do me any favors. I couldn't even get any books to read.
He was just, "No passing, Fernandez, nuh-uh."
Probably he was trying to get promoted. One year, I read 8 Danielle Steele novels in ADSEG. She did a prison novel that is straight-up killer. Everybody was reading it. We tore the book into sections for passing under cell doors, and it was all people talked about. It blew through the prison like a forest fire. It never occurred to me it was odd women in prison would want to read about other women in prison. You want to read about a world you know, not just ones you don't know. I had nothing to do and no one to talk to. I was tired of Betty LaFrance shouting up the vent. I was 18 years old when I'd met her, and she'd impressed the hell out of me. She was rich and called everyone darling, taught manners to women at the county jail. But that was decades ago, and you get sick of people. I'll always love Betty because she's part of my history, and she's just too trippy and weird not to like. But sometimes you want her to quiet down. She kept yelling up through the air vent about her latest plans. She said she was finally going to get back at the rat-faced cop. I told her to hush, but she can't. That's Betty. She started rambling about the Bible. When I was young and stupid, Betty had me convinced the Book of Daniel is really about aliens coming to Earth. She spooked the hell out of me. This time, her ramble was all about judges. "Hey, Sammy, what's sweeter than honey and stronger than a lion?" She kept asking me that through the vent pipe. "Sweeter than honey and stronger than a lion." I didn't know what she was talking about. She's better when it's just about money or her legs that are insured for millions. "The lion is killed by Samson," she said. "He opens the lion's body and there's a beehive inside. Bees make honey, see?" She said honey like it was the key to her riddle, and now I was supposed to understand everything, like honey was some kind of code. "There's honey in the carcass, sweet honey," she said. "But you don't get it unless you kill the lion. First you have to kill the lion." I put a hit on him. I got him cornered. She started talking about the war, but I had tuned her out. "Are you even aware we are at war?" she asked, after I'd stopped responding. "I know about it," I said, but I didn't know much. In county lockup, there's no news on the TV. Too dangerous or something. They give us reruns of Friends. Everyone in jail loves Friends. The characters are practically our bunkies. "There are American soldiers over in Iraq," Betty shouted.
protecting your freedom. They can have my freedom, I yelled back. It sucks. When I was in county, someone on my tier heard from her family that we'd invaded Iraq. I went around asking people if they knew where that is, and not one lady knew. Even the educated people in jail didn't know. It's like these places don't exist until we bomb them. Betty started bothering the guard downstairs. I could hear her through the vent asking him to pray with her for the troops. Talking to Romy got me thinking about the past. I dreamed one night about the snooty fox. I was walking along the balcony outside the rooms. It was daytime and I could hear the traffic on Figueroa. I kept passing rooms with the Do Not Disturb sign on the doorknob, the curtains closed. I came to a room with an open door. The room was vacant and clean, and I went in and shut the door and lay down on the bedspread and fell asleep. I think prison makes you so tired that in the very best dreams you have, you're actually sleeping. That's what we dream about, sleep. When I woke up, I felt like I had gotten much better rest than usual. After Big Daddy put my breakfast through the flap, I shouted to Conan on the end of the tier, told him about my dream. I said I feel like I got double sleep since I was sleeping in my dream at the Snooty Fox. Betty LaFrance shouted up the pipe, "The Snooty Fox? The Snooty Fox? How do I know that name? What is it?" "It's a motel," I said. "I think Doc used to go there," she said. Typical Betty. Everything always has to be about her. The Snooty Fox was my spot. The nicer rooms had a red velvety covering on the bed, and the bed was a massager. You put in coins, and it comes to life underneath you. The showers had two nozzles, one in the usual place up high, and another at the level of the privates. A John of mine, an old man who worked downtown at the courthouse, told me a famous president, Lyndon B. Johnson, had a shower like that, with a crotch nozzle. Lyndon B. Johnson with a shower to wash his balls, just like at the Snooty Fox. The less fancy rooms were $10 an hour. I would negotiate with a John and tell him the room was 20 an hour, or 30, and take that profit on top of what he paid me. But we were only in the room together for maybe 20 minutes. I had people coming in one after another, sometimes five customers in a single hour. One night the Korean lady from the front office comes and bangs on the door while I was with the customer. She was yelling, "Too many uncles! Too many uncles!" "What's she saying?" the guy asked me. He had no idea what was going on. I was laughing so hard. Eventually, I switched to the Hub Motel on Long Beach Boulevard in Compton, where they didn't bother with how many uncles I brought to the room. Long Beach Boulevard was where I met Rodney, right there in the Hub. Not the motel. The Hub was also Compton. I was with Green Eyes, and we'd both just done customers and wanted to buy a rock, but my dealer wasn't around. Green Eyes said she knew someone, so we went to an apartment where this dealer lived. We walked in, and the dealer was Rodney. I thought he was the ugliest person I'd ever seen. He goes to Green Eyes, "Who's that?" pointing at me. And Green Eyes is like, "That's Sammy." And he says to me in a blunt, gruff way, "You like fruit?" I was looking at Green Eyes for a sign, like, how am I meant to answer this? Because we were trying to score, and you can't anticipate about people until you've dealt with them a few times. I was hoping to get a signal from Green Eyes, like, what do I answer? Do I like fruit? And Green Eyes whispers, "Say yes, stupid." See, he was asking me a personal question. It caught me off guard. What did this guy care what I liked? He says, "You want an orange or an apple?" I told him I only liked strawberries and watermelon, that those were my favorite fruits. We left with our rock, me and Green Eyes. Later, I was sitting at the bus stop working, and a car pulls up, and I negotiate, but the guy didn't have enough money, so I let him go. Another car pulls up all slow. The window goes down, and it's Rodney. He says I could get hurt on the street and should be careful. I didn't have a customer, so I agreed to go with him to the store. He bought me some strawberries, and we took them to his house. I stayed there all night, smoking rock, talking,
eating the strawberries, and that was how it started. Now he has my name tattooed in 26 different places on his body. Rodney was from Gonzales, Louisiana. He was in Angola from age 17 to 22. He wears a mustache to cover the scar they gave him with a switch they used for whipping the horses. He had to work planting okra. His feet are ruined from standing in water without rubber boots. When he got out of Angola, they banned him from the state. He took the Louisiana with him out to Compton. He was country and superstitious. No cooking when you're on your menstrual. And his idea of clean was obsessive. It was a lot like how some people act in here, me included. I like it clean. It's a way to have some control, probably. I can laugh at it, though. It's funny that most of us were doing tricks to maintain a crack addiction, living in tents and shitting in buckets on Skid Row, but in here, as shock collars, we make the other women shower 3 times a day and bleach the bathroom after they brush their teeth. We run the room like it's the army, with rules and inspections and yelling and abuse, and I'm the one dishing it. I'll come down on you hard if there's a single drop of water in the sink basin. Rodney used to beat me like a dog. I really did think he did it because he loved me, that it was a form of care, like the strict side of care and love. And I was an addict. I was like every other lost girl with a dealer, girls crippled by dope, and these ballers controlling them with money and power. Rodney had eccentricities. He was a strange person. He ate only bland foods, no salt, no pepper, no ketchup, no hot sauce. No drinking, no drugs, no rap music, no R&B. I mean nothing. He was into money. That was it. Cash. Nothing else. In the morning, I'd get up and drink a 40 of Old English. Rodney would drink a carton of milk, and that was how we each started our day. We dealt together. I worked the night shift. We had 3 security doors along our apartment hall, 1, 2, 3, so no one would rob us. And we kept our stash and money and weapons in a lockbox that was in the floor under the refrigerator, which had a panel you could lift up to get to the lockbox. The guy who installed it was a smoker, so we paid him in rock like we paid everyone. Keep them all dirty, just like in here. I used to keep my whole room dirty, handing out free dope to my cellmates so that no one could rat on me. Rodney was respected in Hub City, but he wasn't a gangbanger. He had a card, a pass. He could deal and they let him be as a loner and non-affiliate. Not everybody gets to walk solo like that, but Rodney was connected to influential bangers, had done a lot of favors for people, and earned his status. We dealt mostly from Rodney's apartment. We handled the sales ourselves. We never had kids on the street corner doing it like how it goes now. The way they exploit these children, you find a kid with a clean record to sell for you. When he gets busted, he won't go to jail since it's his first violation, but he's not useful anymore, so you get a new kid. Go from kid to kid and they all get records. We dealt only in 5s and 10s because the 20s were the bills that narcotics officers marked. I remember a girl came to the gate with 1s and Rodney shoved her into the street and said never to try to buy from him again with her loose change. Rodney and I had 2 Cadillacs. One was root beer brown, and it had an airbrush painting of me on the trunk hood, like I was the Virgin of Guadalupe. And underneath it was written, "Let me tell you about the blues." I was often the only Latina in the room. I got to know a lot of black women, but I've always mixed well with all kinds of people. I'm not into hanging with one race. I can talk to anyone. Rodney would take me to the players' clubs. The girls there are something to look at. They get their hair and nails done every day. If they wait a day on the hair, they sleep with their hands propped under their cheek so their hair won't rub the pillow. You go to the club and everyone is buying bottles of Hennessy. They have strippers on the bar. We like to travel. We went to Vegas, San Francisco. We always dealt on our trips and we carried weapons. We would go up to Sierra Madre where there was an illegal shooting range to practice. It's past the big rock up there. You have to go with the dudes who run it on a dirt road in their huge 4x4. I remember it had a skull for a shifter knob. These crazy white people. They sell hot, clean guns up there. We bought SKSs from them, which came straight from Iran.
The kick on those was amazing. I was a better shot than Rodney. Sometimes we did not agree about how to do business. One morning there was a guy painting a building on the corner near our apartment. He was doing exterior work and started talking to Rodney, and they exchanged information. Later the guy, a white dude, calls and says he wants to buy a large amount of cocaine, but that he's stuck in Laguna Niguel and wants us to come down there. It was pretty clear to me that if he was all the way in Laguna Niguel and a serious buyer, he would have a connection there. Why did he need us? I thought it was an unnecessary risk to go there, but Rodney was stubborn about it because he felt this deal could expand his business. We went. It was a fancy area, just as Rodney had suspected. The houses had long driveways with a call box at the bottom. We get to the box and say who we are, and this huge gate opens by itself. Presto. We motor up to a house with a circular driveway, and the guy comes outside. He hands Rodney the money, and Rodney gives him the dope. Next thing I know, these people came out of the trees. 20 or 30 of them, all in black, with face masks. There was a gun to the side of my head. I had an unlit Camel cigarette in my mouth. It was trembling up and down. The cigarette was bobbling like crazy. I was not scared to be arrested. Fuck no. I'd been to prison 12 times already and considered it part of life. I thought this guy was about to shoot me in the head. That's why I was scared. They pulled Rodney out of the car and pepper sprayed him. We each got 8 years flat. The dude from Laguna Niguel was a rollover. He had set us up in order to clear his own case. Showed up in court, pointing us both out for the prosecution. No shame. Rodney never pursued vengeance on that, but he could have. What you do is hire a private investigator to find the rat. The PIs get a lot of their clients that way in Los Angeles. People think what they do is all about cheating spouses. No, most of their business is from dealers and bangers who need to hunt someone down. Sometimes it's to transact a hit. The PIs, they know not to ask questions. They find the person and that's it. They step back because their job is done. Of course they are aware of what comes next. If it's not a straight hit, the rat gets picked up and taken to a torture garage to learn a lesson. The garages are in secret locations all over South LA. I've been to 2. They hang you from the ceiling. That's not a place where you want to end up. Rodney didn't need a torture garage to punish and control me. Now it seems like he's old and I'm old and we don't bother with each other anymore. After I ran away from Keith, I knew I'd get picked up. I didn't care. It's hard to live on the streets. In prison, you can be someone. Life has order if you know how to do time, and I know. I'm an expert. Living in a tent is a temporary thing. You do it until you go back to prison. That's just how it works. What happened to me is I got tired. Being an addict is a constant hustle. It takes so much energy. When I was in county after they picked me up, I had to kick because I had no access. After I kicked, I just knew, like a light got turned on. I was going to stay clean. Life was going to be different this time around. Chapter 14. Miss Hall, can you stop crying, Miss Hall? If an inmate can't stop crying, they check a box on the suicide risk form. They weren't hoping to spare a life. They were trying to avoid paperwork and internal investigations. They had taken me to a different part of the prison, the nursing facility, where no one could hear me scream, no one but the cop on duty. They were following protocols on a behavior sheet. I was alone in a strip cell, no clothes and no sheets on the bed, on a ward where they put mental cases. My mother had sat in the courtroom, unable to save me, but in a sense, she had saved me, by existing. Now there was no one for me, and no one for Jackson. Those days on suicide watch, I understood how it was that someone might come to believe that the way to get back at these people would be to kill yourself. Being given only spoons and soft food, no forks or knives, forced the mind to wonder in what way a forbidden utensil might be useful. Being given no sheets or pillows summoned a question into the room of how to asphyxiate yourself with what and tied to what.
But I was not suicidal. I was thinking about Jackson and what to do now that we were orphaned. Jackson was the grain of reality in the center of my thoughts. I could see his sweet, open face, made even more open by the cowlick that gave him an old-fashioned, almost brill-creamed hairstyle. He didn't brush his hair. It swooped naturally off his broad forehead. Jackson was handsome like his father had been. Unlike his father, he was always looking to find a way to be happy. When we'd first moved to L.A., Jackson heard the horn of the vegetable truck that parked on our street and went running outside to see what the commotion was. The man who drove the vegetable truck got out and opened the back. The old women lined up in their house smocks to buy groceries from the back of the truck. I felt like the truck was a Mexican thing, and Jackson and I would just go to Vons and shop the regular white people way. But Jackson insisted we get in the line. We bought avocados, mangoes, eggs, bread, and sausages the vendor had hanging from the ceiling of his truck. And the food was half what it cost at Vons. That was how we met all our neighbors. Jackson believed in the world. I searched his face with my closed eyes, felt the dewy touch of his hand in my hand. I heard his voice, felt the warmth of his body when he wrapped his arms around my waist. I focused on the grain of Jackson, the sensation of him. Nothing they did could touch that grain. Only I could touch it and stay close. There was no way to contact him. They wouldn't tell me anything. He needed me and there was nothing I could do. I lay in my tiny bare cell and tried to see Jackson, to visit with him. Jackson wanted me to know things that he knew, to study what he studied, and so he tested me on columns when he learned about them in a Greek coloring book my mother gave him. If there were a bunch of designs at the top, I knew to guess Corinthian. He asked questions like I was someone he could rely on for the truth. Is the heel this whole area of my foot, or just this part on the bottom? He nodded when my answers corresponded to the world he was building in his mind, with correct names and definitions, with facts, testing out his facts. Mommy, that cat might not belong to anyone because she doesn't have a collar. When a man came down Alvarado Street swinging a golf club, hitting telephone poles and then the side of the bus shelter, Jackson said the man had a problem inside his brain, that it was a sickness and he hoped the man got better. Jones, who was my assigned intake counselor, came to check on me. Counselor doesn't mean someone who counsels. Your prison counselor determines your security classification and when and if you get mainlined to general population. Your counselor keeps tabs on you and reports to the parole board if you are headed for parole. Counselors have enormous power over what happens to us, and they are always assholes. I asked Jones if there was some way to find out if Jackson was okay. Was he in a hospital still? What were his injuries? There are privacy rules in hospitals, Hall, Jones said. Do you have children, Lieutenant Jones? Only his legal guardian or a court-appointed advocate can verify that he's in a hospital, Jones said. You are not his guardian, Hall. But who is his guardian? I need to find out the condition my son is in. She was walking away from my cell. I adjusted my tone of voice, hoping to summon her back. Please, Lieutenant Jones, please. It was happening. I was pleading with a sadist in a little girl voice. Jones stopped, pretended to react with decency. Miss Hall, I know it's tough, but your situation is due 100% to choices you made and actions you took. If you'd wanted to be a responsible parent, you would have made different choices. I know it, I said, tears landing on the floor of my cell. I was on the ground on all fours with my face to the food flap in my cell door, which was the only way to communicate with people in the hallway. I tried to think of what Sammy might do. She wouldn't cry. It was hard not to. I vowed to quit. I focused on getting out of the mental ward and back to ADSEG and out of ADSEG and mainlined so that I could try to make phone calls, find a lawyer, get information, do something. I dreamed one night that I was in Jimmy Darling's bed at the ranch in Valencia. Jackson was asleep on a cot. Jimmy had just had a bad dream, he said, in which the police took me away. He held on to me, glad it wasn't real. I was glad too, but then I woke up with caged white lights buzzing in the ceiling above me. Jimmy didn't love me like that. When the police in real life took me away, he moved me to the past. I'd known it when I heard his voice over the county jail phone. You can't remain on suicide watch forever, and you can't stay in ADSEG forever. They need the cells for other people they want to put in ADSEG. 3 months after my mother died, and 4 months after chain night, I was put in general population, on C Yard, in Unit 510. A unit is 260 women on two floors with an open common area and a guard station, a cop shop, in the center. The rooms were big, much bigger than an ADSEG cell, and crammed with bunk beds. Each room was designed for 4 women, but had 8. I was happy to learn I was in Conan's room, and unhappy to learn it was also Laura Lipp's room. She approached as I was fitting a sheet to my mattress. Hi there, I'm Laura Lipp and I'm from Apple Valley. I kept making my bed. That's in the Mojave Desert. It's drier than any bone and there are no apples. Applebee's, though. Laura Lipp didn't remember our 8-hour bus ride together. I didn't question it, wasn't going to insist on familiarity. I was putting my few possessions, the photos of Jackson, into my small locker when another roommate came in. Nuh-uh, she yelled, looking at me. No hillbilly bitches in this room. Get the fuck out. Her name was Teardrop. She was huge and would have destroyed me if I had to fight her, but Conan intervened on my behalf. She's cool. I co-sign her. They went out to the hall to talk. Except I think the Applebee's closed, Laura went on, like nothing had happened. We've had a lot of changes, none of them for the better. I pulled a Fernandez and told her to shut the hell up. The town's got history, though, she said, carefully moving away, out of fist-swinging range, just in case. It was a fine place, and it's gone downhill. We used to be cowboy country. All the country and western people came because of Roy Rogers. He had a museum with a big display of all his fishing lures. He owned the Apple Valley Inn. My father took us there for Sunday dinners. It was a carefree time. There weren't problems like now. You know what people were worried about? Static Kling. That was the big fear on TV and in people's hearts. Static Kling. Conan and Teardrop returned. Don't leave nothing outside your locker, Teardrop yelled at me, but in a slightly nicer tone, like she was resigned to letting me stay. And nobody runs the fucking water, no tap and no flushing, until I get up in the morning. Button Sanchez, who had the baby in receiving, was also in our room. The other 3 roommates were what Sammy would call nondescripts, women with short sentences, minding their own business and staying out of trouble. How I was a hillbilly and Laura wasn't, I didn't understand, until I figured out that Laura was paying Teardrop extorted rent money to stay in our room. As a baby killer, nobody wanted her, so it was possibly her only choice. At dinner, I saw Sammy in line at the chow hall and tried to talk to her. She looked at me and shook her head. A cop shined a light on me. Bust your tray, his voice boomed over a microphone. They give you 10 minutes to eat their shitty food and you have to do it in silence. Mostly it's people who don't have money who go to chow. Teardrop only ever ate in our room from her personal supply of canteen food, ramen bowls that she added water to and heated with a stinger. That evening I put my name on the sign-up sheet and waited in line for the phones in the common area. People were shouting into the phones because others were shouting next to them. The signs on the cinder block walls were the same as in receiving, that cursive plea. Ladies, no whining. Ladies, report to staff if you are experiencing signs of norovirus. Same dirty pink paint on the doors and railings. A color that was probably meant to relax us institutionalized knuckleheads. The line for the phones went fast because the people being called didn't pick up. I dialed my mother. My mother had an account with Global Tel Link, the company that monopolized jail and prison calls. You can't get through to a number that has no Global Tel Link account. I knew she was dead. Still, I had to try. I didn't get through. The public defenders all have Global Tel Link, so I called Johnson's lawyer, but he didn't answer. For the next several days, I signed up for phone calls and waited in line and dialed the lawyer. After my eighth try, I finally reached him. I begged him to help me get information about Jackson. He said he would try, and to give him a week at least. When I finally got through to him again, he said he'd been attempting to figure out who Jackson's case manager was, but had been unable. This work, he said, was really for a dependency court lawyer. Would the state provide one? I asked him, trying to control my tone, not sound angry and desperate. Oh no, he said, and in the gap where I might have pressed him, as if he were obliged to help me, he lunged into that silence before I could and said he was extraordinarily busy with his assigned caseload, and I was not on it, and that he had to get off the phone. As soon as I was eligible, I tried to get a prison job. That was Sammy's advice. Sammy wasn't in my unit, but she was on C Yard, which meant we could hang out in our free time. White girls get all the best jobs, she said. You can clerk, sit in air conditioning, and type letters, while us black and brown women pull used tampons from the septic tank screen for 8 cents an hour. Take advantage. It was true that the clerks were all white. I tried to clerk too, but you had to have a clean disciplinary record, and you had to be liked by the cops. Sammy, Conan, and I all got assigned to the wood shop, which was hiring at 22 cents an hour. Good money. Conan bragged that with his wages, he was going to invest in a tattoo rig, start a side business, and do some art on himself. We were sitting in the common area, waiting for the Friday night movie to begin. They were delayed because the film that was scheduled had profanity. They had to swap it for Driving Miss Daisy, which they'd shown us the Friday before. What tattoo do you want? Sammy asked Conan. A big-ass portrait of Saddam Hussein, Conan said. Tacked up right here. He bulged his bicep. Just to piss off these dickwads. Two unit cops were trying to work the film projector. Support our troops! Conan yelled. Shut the fuck up! Someone else yelled. The movie was starting. Every one of my cellmates got jobs in the wood shop, except for Button Sanchez, who was too young to legally work. Her stomach was flat now. Her face showed no grief that I could see. Her baby was gone. She took classes and, after school, played with her pet rabbit, which she'd caught on Main Yard, and trained. It had a little box under her lower bunk with shredded Kotex in it as a litter thing. It knew where to poop. She took it to class with her, hidden in her state-issue brassiere. I'm its mom, she said. She sewed little clothes for it, made a leash, snuck the bunny on Main Yard so it could see its cousins. It bit her sometimes, and so did the fleas and mites that lived on it. Teardrop told her to get rid of it. Every room of eight had a teardrop. The strongest woman in the room made the rules. Teardrop threatened to roll up Button, put her and her mattress and rabbit in the hall. Button and Teardrop had a knockdown dragout. Button was tiny and Teardrop was huge, but youngsters have a dirty advantage. They'll hit you over the head with a 2x4 if they get the chance. Button went all out, fought Teardrop with a straightening iron. The rabbit got to stay. Fill up your schedule, Sammy said to me. She had known lots of women in my position. Dire as it was, it comforted me to know I wasn't alone. Others had found a way to survive it. I had been in Los Angeles County Jail when the towers of the World Trade Center went down. That was right after I got arrested. We didn't have access to news, but people were getting the details from their families over the phone. Everyone was freaking out, except for one girl who said it comforted her to know she wasn't the only one whose life was wrecked. People got on her, but I knew what she meant. Were you guys close? Sammy asked about my mother. I said no.
Was she healthy?
No.
You might have ended up needing a different guardian for the kid eventually. Things happen in the free world that you can't control.
I could take the money I'd earn working and buy stamps and start flooding state agencies with letters about Jackson, Sammy said. She would help me. The library had directories with agency addresses.
You have to start from where you're at, she said. It was her motto.
On our first day in Woodshop, the prison industry supervisor told us we were going to get excellent on-the-job training skills, which would translate into employment upon our release.
What about those of us who don't got a release date? Teardrop asked.
Normally, you can't work in prison industries, he said. Normally, we can't use you because you don't need the training since you're not getting out, and this is all about training people to work jobs. But we have a lot of orders to fill, so you've found yourself in a lucky position. You will learn to build furniture here, and I can tell you ladies that a Finnish carpenter makes great money.
Conan was impressed with his shop.
Dang, we get to use real wood, table saws, miter boxes?
At Wasco, the wood shop isn't even real. The wood there is all compressed particle board. You glue these pieces together. That's your only tool, glue. You can't even drive in a nail or that stuff will split and crumble. We weren't learning anything. I told the supervisor, you keep talking about Finnish carpentry and we don't make stuff that will teach us it. He goes, that's because you people are animals and if we give you tools, you'll kill each other. I ask him, what are we here to learn? And he says, you're here to learn how to work, to show up on time, to be workers, as if that's a thing. We didn't learn shit at the Wasco woodshop. We huffed glue all day. Then they came up with this huff-free glue. No huff, it was called. That was its name. No huff glue. You can't huff it. It doesn't do anything. No power tools, no learning curve, no drug high. It was better than the other prison industries, though. The outfit down the hall, those dudes were making safety goggles for prison industries, and next to that building, they made boots for prison industries.
I was assigned to a workbench.
I'm 100% Norse, my new bench partner said.
The Norse was 6 feet tall, with long blonde hair divided into several braids. The tattooed head of a bald eagle emerged from the top of her woodshop coveralls. The eagle on her chest had an American flag in its beak. It looked mad, even madder than eagles usually look. The supervisor put Laura Lip next to me and the Norse.
Can I be moved? I asked.
No, he said.
Thank God, the Norse said. Whites. She looked over at Conan, Teardrop, Reebok, the three black people I'd walked in with.
How do you feel about blacks? She asked me and Laura Lip.
Laura Lip, eager for such rare acknowledgement, someone asking her a question, lunged to answer.
Oh, I try to be colorblind, but it's not always... I mean, some people have had to come further than others in order to...
Do you let them eat your pussy is what I need to find out.
Laura gasped. Heavens no!
I run this bench, and I need to know who is who, the Norse said.
Well, since you bring that up, I agree about sexual relations, as my husband was Hispanic and that was a disaster, ruined my life, but you might be interested to hear that I fainted one evening and the girls who came to my aid were black and...
The Norse ignored Laura Lip and moved toward me.
Do you like Iron Maiden? She asked.
That's what I play.
We have a radio?
I'm the radio in this part of the shop.
That afternoon, the Norse hummed. Run to the Hills and Iron Man were on repeat. I was in high school all over again. But when she asked where I was from, nodded and said, Frisco, cool. I was reminded that I was very far from where I was from. I didn't ask her anything. I couldn't have been less interested in knowing details about her Nazi lowrider brothers and boyfriends in San Bernardino or wherever. That's snobbery, but there's a cultural difference. The Sunset District was not exactly classy, but we were adjacent to the Haight-Ashbury, and by that proximity to weirder cultures, not straight dirtheads,
even if there were among us people who became full-on white supremacists, like Dean Conti, the sad kid from my junior high who was relentlessly made fun of. Dean Conti had experimented with various solutions to being maladjusted. Nerd, new waver, skateboarder, peace punk, hardcore punk, eventually skinhead, and finally, neo-Nazi in a suit and tie. When he was a skinhead, Dean and his friends ruined the Hate Street Fair. By 6 p.m. when the fair was ending and loading trucks were packing up the stage and the vendors' tables, the air became 90% beer bottles, a forehead-height kill zone thanks to the skinheads. Back when Dean had still been a nerd, he invited a bunch of kids who cut school to his father's place on Hugo Street, and we drank all his dad's liquor and set the curtains on fire. I forgot about that until I saw him all grown up on television. He was on a talk show as a spokesman for white supremacy. One of the skinheads on the show threw a chair at the host and broke his nose. Dean became famous. I still saw the kid, though, in the man. I'm not justifying his ideas. It's just that he was someone I knew. He was in love with Eva, and Eva was Filipino, but that had not deterred him. It's always like that. I knew a guy in high school who later went to prison and joined the Aryan Brotherhood. The guy who joined the Aryan Brotherhood had a black girlfriend and mixed kids. Things are more complicated than some can admit. People are stupider and less demonic than some can admit. Before lunch, Laura Lip drilled her own hand with a drill press and was sent to the infirmary. That was it for her in Woodshop. The Norse said it was her punishment for marrying a beaner. The Norse had been in prison so long she didn't know that particular slur had gone out of style, was no longer used, and this made me unexpectedly sad for her. I don't know if it was right or wrong, but Jimmy Darling and I had shared the habit of sometimes feeling sorry for bigots. Like the lonely woman tending an empty bar whom we met while driving around Valencia, where Jimmy taught. The challenge of finding anything notable in that strip mall hell was something we both enjoyed. One night we passed a trailer park in Santa Clarita with a shabby sign that said, Adult Living. Man, Jimmy said, the things you can look forward to. We speculated that maybe they had glass shower stalls in those trailers, waterbeds. It was a place for adults, adults only. We found a tavern on an abandoned county road that was itself almost abandoned. The bartender said she was in the process of buying the place, but didn't want a Mexican clientele. Mexicans will stab you first thing minute you turn around, she said. She asked us how we thought she might bring in more white people. Offer sandwiches, Jimmy said. Damn, that's a good idea. She and Jimmy brainstormed about her deli. Pickles, Jimmy said. Potato chips. She didn't know he wasn't serious. He was, and he wasn't serious. On the wall above us in the wood shop were brochures with pictures of the furniture proudly manufactured by inmates at Stanville Prison Industries woodworking facility. This is what we made. Judges' benches. Jury box seating. Courtroom gates. Witness stands, lecterns, judges' gavels, paneling for judges' quarters, wooden courtroom cages for in-custody defendants, wood frames for the state seal that goes in the judges' chambers, and judges' seats, which then went to upholstery next door. Not among the state merchandise we built, someone, sometime, had crafted a child's desk, like you see in schools, with a hinge so the top can open to store supplies inside. It had a small matching chair. The desk and chair were at the entrance to the wood shop. That little desk makes me sad, Conan said. I trained myself not to look at it. When thoughts moved in about my mother, dead, really and truly dead, I reminded myself that Jackson was not dead. She was, but he wasn't. I confined myself to this very small form of relief. On weekends, Sammy and I went out to Main Yard. The sight of thousands all dressed alike is really striking the first time you see it. People clustered, catching up and hanging out, playing basketball or handball. Girls brought out guitars and strummed for small audiences, no gathering in groups larger than five. Some huddled and did drugs, others had love affairs in the porta-potties or out in the open with lookouts, pinners, watching for cops. It was summer and the hot wind rippled our loose clothing, which ranged from the palest blue to navy to the granite speckle of denim, our fake jeans. The denim is not fake, the jeans part is. They are pants sewn crudely of denim with an elastic waistband and a single lopsided, too small pocket, and they are not jeans, as I think of the term. Sammy and I walked the track. We passed the 213 girls, who all waved to her. Main Yard has area codes, just like the state. Signs everywhere said, "No running except on track." If you ran anywhere else, they could shoot you. Who got her the wire cutters? Who are you talking about? Angel Marie Janicki. Man, she was fine, Sammy said. She was the best-looking girl at Stanville. Where did she get the wire cutters? Free World staff, some guy. He was under the influence. I'm telling you, she was beautiful. Orders issued from the PA, clear and tight and loud. You by the bathrooms. I can see you smoking. Put that out right now. Lozano, you're out of bounds. A truck circled the perimeter of the prison on a dirt road between the electrified fence and the outer, final fence. Copley, you left your dentures by the handball courts. Audible laughter from the other guards near the microphone. Copley, come to the watch office to pick up your teeth. When it was hot, the guards mostly stayed in the air-conditioned watch office and observed us through binoculars. They did that when it was cold, also. The yard is massive, and they are lazy. Which blind spot did she use? Behind the gym. That's why we have lockdowns now. There's before Angel Marie Janicki, and there's after. They can't see the fence behind the gym? Not from Tower 1, but they don't need to now. They have the electric fence. It took the perimeter truck at least 10 minutes to circle the grounds. Maybe 11. How the guards know whose dentures? The inmate number is printed on the side in the artificial gums. We passed Whale Beach just as the guards started breaking up their sunbathing party. Whale Beach, no slingshots. Whale Beach, I said no slingshots. Everybody up and dressed. It's not nice to say Whale Beach, but that's what it's called, an area beyond the walking track where women grease up and fry. Slingshots are homemade undershirts. You were not supposed to bare flesh on Main Yard, but people did anyhow, slathered in cook oil or the fake butter they use in Central Kitchen, a brand called I Can't Believe It's Not Butter, or, as Conan called it, I Can't Fucking Believe This Shit's Not Butter. No one runs on the track since this was women's prison and we were not training to kill. No one except Conan, who jogged past me and Sammy. I just slaughtered 10,000 gnats with my open mouth. He turned around, running backward, facing us. Try closing your mouth, Sammy said. You won't have that problem. A female cop hurried past. No sitting on the tables, she yelled. It was also illegal to sit under them, which was the only way to get shade on the yard. Only regulation sitting was allowed. Conan regarded the cop angrily marching past. He nodded approval. Boy, she was a different lay. At Stanville, you can assume it's a lie if the person volunteers it. It's also a lie if the person says it in answer to a question. Conan's tails were as tall as Tower 1 and Tower 2, where armed FUDs tracked us and ate pork rinds. She says to me, "Don't just use your tongue. I want you to hum into me like I'm a kazoo." That's what she said, like I'm a kazoo. The landscaping crew was working along the edges of the track with spray bottles of Roundup. Their job was to keep the yard one seamless expanse of dirt. "We keep it real tidy," said Laura Lipp, who was now on yard crew. A top layer of bare dirt lifted and blew around from Valley Gus as a new cop named Garcia came toward us. All new staff are marks for prisoners and cops alike, but there was something particularly vulnerable about Garcia. He seemed lost out there on Main Yard, which is 3 yards, B, C, and D.